Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. Today we'll be talking to Austin Bay. Austin Bay is an author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net.
Welcome, Austin. Like to talk a little bit this morning about what our options are with the Islamic, fighting the Islamic State. Maybe though first you could just take 1 minute and clear up the, we refer to it on Strategy Page as ISIL, or the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant. The media, mainstream media calls it ISIS because I think that sounds cooler. What's more correct? Why the confusion?
When it initially broke out, Dan, the more direct translation of their name is Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. But ISIS, yeah, I think it does sound cooler. Reminds you of an Egyptian goddess. I believe that's part of what the pickup there was. I mean, they're referring to the same terrorist organization, but Greater Syria, and this is at least the Syrians' notion of it, is the Levant. So you would, you know, there's some connection there. I think ISIL is more accurate. But now since the end of June, I think it was June 28th, that they declared themselves the Islamic State. So I guess it's IS.
Just the Islam, yeah. IS.
Yeah, we're the U.S. and they're the IS. Okay, so, all right.
Right, and really what they're looking for is the reestablishment of the caliphate. Right?
Oh, they claim they've reestablished it.
No, so they've already done
That's
it.
That's right. they've done it, and there it is. So,
So, Austin, what are some of the options that we, the United States and the rest of the world, has laying in front of them? But this brand of, we faced Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has sort of morphed into ISIL or whatever you want to call it. But it seems like it's become nastier and meaner. Not that they weren't already nasty and mean, but I mean they've taken it up a notch, it seems.
I really don't think they've taken it up a notch in terms of the brutality and massacre. Daniel Pearl's head was cut off by Taliban, and as I recall, they've done this before. They connect this with this kind of violence through 1300 years. So they're not any more bloodthirsty and focused there's a kind of nihilism, ultimate nihilism about it, even though they see themselves as bringing about a just society on Earth. That's when Jim and I write about the comparison between 19th century anarchists and the late 20th and early 21st century Islamist movements. The anarchist idea was that all of the terrible violence wreaked was morally justified because a more just society would emerge, and they're claiming that they're the emergence, I'm talking about Islamic State now, of that more just society run by a caliph. But you ask, what can we do about it? Well, there's the option of quote-unquote doing nothing, but if you refuse war and ignore war, war will find you, and these are the kind of guys that find you. You said you thought that they might have taken Al-Qaeda up a notch. I see these guys as Al-Qaeda. Remember, they're an Al-Qaeda, there's an Al-Qaeda rift, supposedly, where they have succeeded in or taken it up a notch, Dan, is their territorial claim. Now, Al-Qaeda controlled base areas in Afghanistan. It's had safe areas and the like, but Islamic State has claimed territory, and I've noticed some pretty good commentary saying, now that gives them a power base note how successful they were in looting banks in Mosul and the like. They've got money. They've got control of the smaller oil fields in eastern Syria, where their base area was, and then the oil fields in northern Iraq. They can either threaten them or take control of some of them. I think that's getting ahead of the game because they really, even though they have succeeded apparently in doubling their size from about 5,000 committed fighters to 10,000, they're still short on manpower. And that's what they need to really assert control. Cutting off heads and murdering Yazidis is an attempt to secure control by terror. Now, by threat, they are short. Again, they're short people. They are not able to police their territory. Now, the flip side of claiming a territory is now you've got a place to attack. And I wrote a column now 2 weeks ago saying that you're back with the potential for what was flippantly called the flypaper strategy in early 2003. I called it the attractor. As a matter of fact, there's a column of mine that late January 2003 that discusses this. Al-Qaeda can't ignore Iraq, is what I said. And they're going to have to come there and fight it. And now America is putting together have thrown them off their timeline, and we're setting the battlefield. And I think that happened. I know that happened. Al-Qaeda suffered a terrible defeat in Iraq. Al-Zarqawi's guys showed up and they got killed. Same can be obtained if, now here's another option, concerted, directed effort to destroy the Islamic State. And here the Obama administration has some components that are already in place. Kurdish Peshmerga, okay, the Islamic State. Caught them off guard. The Peshmerga is short weapons. That's going to be corrected. I noticed yesterday even Germany is strongly considering. They didn't commit, but it's all but a commitment to supplying supplying weapons. There are other weapon sources for the Kurds. Part of that happened because of Nouri al-Maliki's decision to cut Kurdish forces out of the military supply chain. Boy, was that short-sighted on Maliki's part. Now, this is a huge difference from 2003, Dan, and it's lost in a lot of the major media commentary. In 2014, you do have an Iraqi army. It is not all crooked, corrupt, and inept. The forces out that were when they were still ISIL or ISIS overran in June, yeah, total mess. What are they fighting for? What kind of, however, there's a strong, capable, and when I say capable, might be average or below average by Western standards, but nevertheless, it's a force. There's an army on the ground, and it has manpower, it has resources. They even have armed helicopters, and they rented what was it, 8 Su-25 Frog feet from the Russians. They needed air power. So when I said that you've got those two pieces and then American air power and American intelligence on this, Islamic State is caught in an uncomfortable pincer. Now, does it need U.S. forces? Well, does it need Jordanian forces? Does it need Turkish forces? I'm adding some other components to it. Jordan and Turkey have enormous interests in stopping the Islamic caliphate. Actually, a number of other states in the area do as well. Iran certainly knows it does. The Assad regime knows it does. And curiously enough, the Syrian moderates that do exist, they've been fighting some of these guys. A splinter faction that a Sunni extremist splinter faction, the names is escaping me now, even though they were a rival of the guys that formed the Islamic State. It's some of the infighting between the various rebel groups reflected between the militant Islamist extremists and various moderate groups and ethnic groups. you've got a political, the point to draw here is that you've got a political base throughout the region that bring these disparate polita together to focus on destroying them. So, listen, what else should the United States do? I mean, that's what can we do? I take it that way. Is that who's going to be the leader and form this coalition? Well, Dan, here's the question. Name a nation, and I can name two, sort of, that has successfully organized a coalition of the willing to accomplish a tough military task such as this, other than the United States in the last 30 years. Can you?
No.
Can you name any but 40? 50? All right. Yeah. There's argument that Britain has taken the lead on some issues in East Africa, which we've covered, and that's I won't go overboard with it. And here's the other one: Nigeria with ECOWAS in West Africa, but Nigeria had direction and help from the United States and Great Britain, actually the West, and that was dealing with the terrible Liberian civil war. And ECOWAS was something of a mess, but it was the Nigerian government attempting to put together a functioning coalition to deal with a grievous situation within their own region. When I point to East Africa, you have Uganda and Kenya acting about Somalia, and Great Britain, the U.S. has been involved in that, but Great Britain has played a role in it. But I'm talking about big movements, big major muscle movements, political and military. This is where the United States leads from the front. Now, that does not mean massive deployment of U.S. forces, but I do see this, and everyone who reads and listens to Strategy Talk and has read my columns about this, Iraq needed a continuing American mentoring and security presence. Now, General Lloyd Austin, lieutenant, when he was, I think he is CENTCOM commander now, but when he was commander in Iraq, he came up with the 15,000 figure as a, not just a fire brigade, but really as a mentoring training, military training element remaining in Iraq, and at the same time, a honest broker serving on the security presence, particularly among the Sunnis in the Baghdad area and then the Sunni tribes in Anbar that had joined the Sunni awakening. They certainly had a political element to it. My own number, and before he came out with it, I 15,000, I'll accede to him, but I kind of did one of my back-of-the-envelope assessments on knowing what I know about Iraq, and I came up with around 20,000. But that's in the same zone. That's a remnant force beyond December 31st, 2011. U.S. does operate in countries without status of forces agreements. I just tossed that out. There seem to be people that think that that's totally determinative. No, that's not the case. Large scale deployment, another thing too that has been pointed out by what I think is really informed commentary, the Iraqi demand for the imposition of potential imposition of Iraqi courts on American soldiers was a starting offer. There was really little negotiation going on with on the part of the Obama administration. Well, we're left. All right, I've outlined the political component. The air power application is extremely vital to for the Kurds and Iraqi army, but the United States needs to think the problem through. Realize that this is a long, hard slog, and I'm ripping off Rumsfeld's line. He really wasn't the first person to say that, but he, long hard slog, has become something of a good title for the West's struggle with Islamic militants. I said this several years ago on a strategy talk. I'll bring it out again. When I was in 2002, and I was in Singapore working on an article on Islamic militants in Southeast Asia, which was later published in the Weekly Standard. I was speaking to a professor at one of the universities there in Singapore, and he happened to be Malaysian and a Sunni Muslim. And he said to me, he says, Mr. Bay, you know, we've been fighting this war a lot longer than you have. And I said, yes, I realize that. And he knew, because he'd read several things I'd written, he knew that I understood that a lot of this is an intra-Islamic war. You have the idea that Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State represents most Muslims is just totally false. It does it enthuse a certain kind of alienated 19, 20, 21-year-old Muslim man that has few prospects and lives in a crooked country? Yeah. But the vast majority, you might get, if you with a quick telephone poll, get an expression of attaboy. But the thing is, there's also deep, long-standing outrage because they know what these guys do. They kill, and the Islamic State has killed Sunnis, has killed Shias, and they just kill. And so my point about that is to get back to it. This is a long fight, and the U.S. is going to have to reconsider supporting Iraq in the long term with, how'd I phrase it, a mentoring and security presence.
Talk a little bit more about the Kurds and how they could be used more effectively.
Well, now that is some of that requires speculation. How could they be used more effectively? For one thing, is they see that their territory, or Kurdish regional government, Iraqi Kurdistan, has been stolen. How could they be used? They've already got the raison d'etre to deal with these guys. They need more weapons, more ammunition. They need better intelligence, which we can provide, and they need air cover. What else do you want? They've got a cadre of solid fighters. So they, despite their poor showing initially, they do, and they need some support weapons when the Islamic State showed up with some of the heavier artillery that they had captured. Maybe it all wasn't captured. We don't know for sure. They may have captured some from the Syrian army in eastern Syria or the like. That caught the Kurds off guard. Well, U.S. Air power more than compensates for that. It turns the Islamic State artillery crews into easy targets, comparatively easy targets. So support them. The quick answer is provide them with the logistics support and the air support they need.
So do you think that there is any probability that we'll try to put some forces on the ground at some point, at least to sort of backstop the Iraqi army?
Well, look, my mentoring and security presence would be a deep backstop of a type, which is what it was supposed to be anyway, because you really had, look, in 2011, Vice President Biden was touting Iraq as a success of the Obama administration. He did it in 2010 as well, and the kind of a famous bit, I think, was on Larry King. I mean, it's on the web. It was stable enough. That president said it himself. Well, you could. There's a goal to return to. Now, how do you get there? Does that require an American security presence? Yes, it does. What does that entail? I do not know. I've given you some ideas, and I quoted, off the top of my head. And I, of course, our audience out there, hey, babe, General Austin's number was, no, I believe it was 15,000, but it's all ballpark on that. And that's if you're going to ask me, do I think the current administration right now is prepared to do that? My answer would be no. But in 3 to 4 months, things can change. Okay? So.
Right. Now, with the beheading incident, it looks like the Brits are starting to become somewhat more engaged over this. Where do you think that they may be headed as far as their involvement with helping out forces in Iraq to oppose ISIS?
All right, Dan, Great Britain is going to have to make... Great Britain is in the process of gearing up to support, and that's the way I see it, regional allies. Now, who does that consist of? Kurds, Iraqi Kurds, Iraqi state, Jordan. I take a wild guess on perhaps some of the more moderate Syrian rebel groups, and might be operating with the French on that. Here is something that I thought about actually this morning before we started the strategy talk about the British. And it's interesting then that you brought it up, is that the British have been wrestling what to do with domestic Islamic militants within Great Britain. And based on what I read yesterday and the Daily Telegraph and another British newspaper, there was reason to believe the man who executed Foley has a British passport or has lived in Britain. And when he speaks English, he has a British accent. There, you may see some heavy tightening up on the part of the Brits there. The reports that ISIS has successfully recruited, quote-unquote, several hundred European Islamic militants. Now, with European passports and the like. There's one article I read speculating that it was 1,500 to 2,000. That's a huge number. And some of these, who knows where some of these guys came from, but they're there. There's certainly enough of them there that that we have hard evidence that they exist. You could see, if Great Britain does that, you could see the rest of Europe make the same kind of change. Because the atrocities, this is where these organizations like the Islamic State make their really fatal mistake. They cannot control their nihilistic violence. They see that as a statement of their power. And I showed you even now, I see part of what they're doing is trying to keep the population down because they don't have enough combat personnel yet. They don't. It's a reign of terror. The other thing, too, is that Great Britain and the United States are key players in cutting off financial resources to terrorist groups. The sad thing is that, and I'm just basing this on what I've read, is that the Islamic State really fattened its wallet with all the banks it hit, and there was apparently a lot of cash in several of the banks. So they targeted their banks. So you can see some of this is a big time robbery. Not trying to be flip with that. That's just the case.
Yeah, and where it's almost like they've doubled their funds, other than having to do their normal charity work that they do.
Maybe tripled their funds. I mean, or quadrupled. We don't know. Yeah. Some of this. Look, again, some of the better commentaries. And some of the best, yeah, I'm going to say it, you see what you've shown up on strategy page with what Jim's been doing over the last, really the last 2 months with these guys, but is that there are a lot of things we really don't have hard numbers on. What we do know is that there were indications coming out of Syria, regional intelligence groups, that about what the ISIL was forming. ISIL had larger intentions, and there was a struggle going on with quote-unquote control of the movement and the radical group that running the what is now the Islamic State had severe disagreements with al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, notionally, assuming that it was al-Zawahiri who did it, kicked these guys out of al-Qaeda. That was now those... Those seem to be fairly well accepted indicators that now, how did it morph so quickly? Well, they had weapons, they had a place in eastern Syria, and they saw a power vacuum in Iraq, and they moved.
Yeah,
and they also knew how to some of this too is taking advantage of genuine Sunni Arab, this is my read on this now, my opinion, but genuine Sunni Arab grievances, with the Iraqi government. And the way Maliki was running a crony operation, the hero in this, there are many, but it's Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. I mentioned him several weeks ago when he said, he all but came out and said, we must have a new government. He said that, and he's very careful in the way he makes these kind of statements because he's from the so-called quietist philosophy of Muslims, meaning that I'm a spiritual leader, I'm not a political leader. He frustrates a number of the Ayatollahs in Iran for having a Shia Grand Ayatollah, but that's him. And I read, and this was sent to me last night by an Iraqi friend of mine who is he's a Sunni Arab, but he lives here in the United States. As a matter of fact, he's got a U.S. green card, he's lived here for 30 years. But he reads all of the Iraqi news sites, and every once in a while he sends me a interesting tidbit. Well, this was really interesting. And it was basically says, hey, Austin, this is what Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani said about the Shia soldiers who've been carrying around Shia flags. I don't know if you'd read about that, but some of them had in one of the battles. He says, stop it. Carry an Iraqi flag. We are fighting with our friends and brothers, against an enemy. I said, wow, where'd he find it? He got it off. He had the link on there. Of course, I couldn't read it. It was in Arabic, but he'd seen it on what he said was a rather common popular Iraqi news site. Now, that I haven't seen that filter into the Western press. British press, some of the defense press, the U.S. will cover it. And, I got an email from a friend of mine who sends me stuff. And sometimes the stuff is outlandish and it's wrong. So, but this doesn't sound outlandish. This is right in line with the way Ali al-Sistani has conducted his provides guidance and has for the last 30 odd years. He had let it be known the suffering he sees, the suffering under Saddam was a vicious dictatorship, but also the suffering due to anarchy and violence continues, and it needs to end. And he says, and Iraq needs a stable, functioning, and just government. And just government means that all elements of Iraqi society have a say. So there's, and he's highly respected among the Shia. And I know that many Iraqi Sunnis seem as in the background as really he's really kind of an Iraqi nationalist. Well, he's for a stable state where people can live in peace, and that's not there are guys out there like that. Don't be cynical about it. That is a sign of why there is and has been something to build on in Iraq. And I, you know, let me conclude this too. I wrote a column about this after I got back from my tour of duty in Iraq. And Dan, I guess I started counting after I had this told to me four or five times. So all told, 15 or 16 times, I had Iraqis that I met. Now, let's say most of them, sure, were educated and they spoke English, but I sometimes had an interpreter with me, and I had a couple of instances of talking with guys who were working on projects in the street through the interpreter. And I got this said to me in several ways, but basically this is our chance to escape bad history. This is our chance to build a real modern country. This is our chance to actually make something and do something. That was kind of the construction worker take on it. The escape bad history was said to me by a fellow who happened to be an economist, and he had a PhD from Baghdad University, and he was working as a liaison from the Iraqi Agricultural Ministry. I met him in the green zone because I had American civilian advisor I know was working actually on a project with him, and he said, "Look, you know something about what's going on. This is our chance." And he says, "I know lots of us don't want to lose it. You're not." And I said, "Okay, thanks for telling me that." And I told him, I said, "I've already heard this eight or nine times in my own way." And he says, "Well." He says, "You're listening," is what he told me. I said, "Okay." And then I heard it some more. Now, I got some blowback from that column saying that I was a liar and I was for Bush and all this other stuff. Hey, you know, I wasn't a liar. I know that's there. And I also know the grievances are there. The grievances and the grievances of the Sunni Arabs that joined the awakening and then got the shaft from Maliki. And Maliki wasn't a total failure. There's some things he did, but he also, look, he was an inadequate man. He was at best an interim man, and the time for the change was when Iyad al-Alawi's Iraqi list actually had a plurality of the votes in an election, and what Maliki did was rely on sectarian groups. He went Shia in order to retain the prime ministership. And that was Alawi, who was the Iraqi list, was really much more secular, even though Alawi himself is a Shia Muslim. You had Sunnis in that. You had genuine Western-oriented liberals, and they want a plurality, but that's also past history. However, you can learn from the past. Yep. And Iraq shows there's some Iraq, I think, has learned. Right. Now, can it be applied? Heaven knows. They need security. They need mentoring. And when I say mentoring, that's not us just sitting there, do it this way. All the things they ask, give us advice on how you do it, and then let us decide. And I've got anecdotes involving that, but even involving accounting. A young captain I know that was involved in one of the training operations, I'm going to say 2007, 2008. I guess I talked to him in 2009, ran into him, and he said, interestingly enough, an Iraqi battalion commander had asked him and another guy on the team, "Hey, you guys know anything about bookkeeping?" Hell no. And I mean, it actually happened twice. The brigade commander said, "Look, we know some of the, but help us with this because, you know, this is something we need to improve." And I thought, well, of course, these guys are looking at running better organizations. You know, they were thinking like good commanders and the skills we need. Talk to us about this. We'll figure out how to shoot, you know. So that's just an anecdote on it. And it was brought up to them. Well, you and it turned out one of the guys on the team, I know how to do that. And so they did it.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the West will figure out how to support them the best and we can...
Danny, of course, it's not perfect. Learning process, a lot of violence, and you run into... are there multiple interests? Of course. And a lot of multiple interests can be sensationalized, and to break up an alliance, this is the violent nihilist murderer's advantage. You toss a grenade into the tent where the people are holding a powwow, and you kill them all, or you try to make it look like the other side sold them out. That's what the violent do all the time.
So, right. All right. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking about this more at another time.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right.
And we'll talk to you next time.
All right. Bye.
Bye.